So I'm going to be very brief. They always say the only rule for a moderator is to tell everyone to turn off their cell phones or their BlackBerry. So please do so. We're very happy to have Matthew Crabb. I don't, how many people in this room get Access Asia's weekly report, the thing they sent out on the internet? One, two, well, you know, three. I think many people would argue that about the best publication that comes out of China on what is going on in China business is the weekly internet thing that Access Asia puts out under Matthew Crabb's name. I've never really been clear if Matthew Crabb really wrote this thing, but you can. He and his partner Paul French put these things out. Matthew lives in Malaysia, but he's a China writer. Do you write in Malaysia as well, or do you write almost in? He's a China server, right? I'm interested. But anyway, this book on China they put out in 2 years, and if you see all the material that he and his partner put out, it's extraordinary. I mean, as a writer who struggles to do sentences and paragraphs and stories, I'm actually quite awed. So anyway, I think it's good that you came without reading the letter, but if you had read that letter, you definitely want to be here. So I'm just delighted to introduce Matthew Crabb, and I hope that we have a very vigorous discussion, and I hope you write down questions. And I'll try to recognize everyone that has a question. I think the more interactive we can make these panels, the better, because it'll allow this place to become what it really should be, which is an exchange of information. And I know that many of you are experts in these fields as well. So, Matthew, please.
I'll give you a brief introduction as to my pedigree, if you like. I graduated from Leeds University in 1991, having studied Chinese for 4 years, including a year in Beijing, where I was 88 and 89, and we were basically kicked out of the country, or rather evacuated, because of the whole Tiananmen crisis. I then went on to work for a Chinese language newspaper in the UK, which got me into writing business articles about business exchange between the UK Chinese population and mainland China, which then led me into the Mercury World of Market Research, where I joined Euromonitor, and that's where I met Paul French. We realized that the model for doing research on China based on the kind of European market research model didn't really fit, so we decided to go it alone. That was in 1998, and we've been running Access Asia ever since. We also set up Access Asia on the back of our last collaborative book, which was called 1 Billion Shoppers, which looked at the emergence of a consumer economy throughout Asia and the repercussions and forecasting. And that, of course, in 1998 was following the whole financial crisis in Asia. So we had to quickly edit and rewrite the projections in that book. But it continues, obviously, to recover and to prosper as a region. And we have continued to write pretty much exclusively on China. Coming back to the question about whether or not we write on, say, countries like Malaysia, we have actually tried to drum up information and interest in that information on other countries. But everybody just keeps coming back to China, so China, you know, has continued to be. Apart from doing research into different product sectors in China, which is our core work at Access Asia, one of the things that we also do is try and understand the wider picture, why consumers perhaps choose a certain product over another, rather than just looking at the products themselves, but looking at the wider society in China and how that's changed and how that's affecting different markets. So we occasionally look into various different aspects of society in China, both professional interest but also personal interest as well. And 3 or 4 years ago, we started seeing results of survey information about different aspects of Chinese society where there were problems, such as mental health issues, suicide rates, and obesity emerged as one of those. And basically, a few years later, the book came out of it. It was a discursive process in which we were sort of exchanging ideas back and forth between us, sort of collecting bits and pieces of information here and there. We were also presenting the idea and the concept of the obesity problem in China to various conferences, and mostly looking at it in terms of the potential cost for the healthcare system in China. And one of the first questions that people ask about the book is, well, how big, you know, how bad is the problem? I'll just have to flip through to relevant pages. Looking at, one of the first problems that we had, and I was discussing this with somebody last night, was how do you define obesity and overweight? And I think one of the key issues here is that it's still a very vague science. I'm not a dietitian or able to add any medical gravitas to the argument, so I can't say whether certain measurements are correct or open to dispute. But there seems to be that dispute, and medical professionals that we did speak to say there is a problem in how you define obesity, particularly when you're looking at different racial groups and lifestyles and body types. All these seem to have an influence that a simple measurement like a body mass index doesn't really quite grasp. And in fact, the person I was talking to yesterday, he said he had actually been classed as clinically obese, although he looked perfectly fine. He's just one of those people with a very big frame and very dense bones. So there's a real problem in actually identifying the size of the problem, because the definitions just aren't clear enough yet. One of the things that we started gathering was the survey information that was being carried out in different parts of China across different periods. And one of the first studies that we looked at was some figures that were compiled in 1982 in China that found that 7% of the population were overweight. Then a decade later, there was in 1992, there was another survey that suggested that 15% were overweight. So in 10 years, that amount had doubled almost. There wasn't then another proper survey until one conducted again 10 years later in 2002, the results of which were published in 2003. And that survey had discovered that 22.8% of Chinese adults were overweight and 7.1% were clinically obese. So again, it had doubled, or nearly doubled. So it's obviously a significant problem. It's developed very quickly, so that's just in the last 20 years. So we saw these figures and started to think, okay, this is quite a serious and significant trend, particularly when you take into account the cost of treatment for the illnesses that tend to be associated with obesity. We looked at whatever available information there was at the time. Most of it was from surveys and research carried out in the United States. And one of the things that we found in terms of the US research was that different illnesses associated with obesity, such as heart disease, diabetes, likelihood of stroke, and various other diseases, if you actually costed those, and including days lost from illness from work, you included those, that the cost of, in terms of healthcare spending in the US, obesity was accounted for 31%, which is a fairly significant amount of money. We then looked at what the likely capita costs would be in terms of the drugs and the treatments in China, and again, I have to stress that this is very much a thumbnail sketch, but we had to try and produce something of an estimate, and that estimate actually worked out at a very similar rate of total healthcare spending in China, about 31%. But this is in China at the time when we completed the book, slightly before they started really ramping up the amount of spending on healthcare, which has really only been in the last couple of years, 2-3 years, I think, that they've started pouring more money into the infrastructure. But you can't, it's our belief that you can't really legislate necessarily against obesity as a problem. You can't tell people not to eat so much. People will eat whatever they want to eat, what they can afford to eat. And one of the key things that we looked at in China was why people are getting fatter. What are the forces driving this change in people's shape and size and the habits, their eating habits? As where, again, the comparison with the US came up, and we looked at the US, and every sort of study that we looked at said that the problem of obesity in China, in the US, is generally focused on low-income, low-educated people. Whereas in China, we found it was the opposite. It was generally fairly well-off people, almost majority of which were urban, and very, generally very young as well. And we looked sort of further into the different reasons in terms of the way that society has changed in China. And we realized that having gone from, say, 30 plus, 40 years ago, in a state of near famine, or famine indeed, at the time, if you go back further to the Great Leap Forward, sort of even sort of 30 plus years ago when the economic reforms were first started, the levels of income, the levels of calorie intake, and the affordability of food changed dramatically in those past 30 years. People now in China, their per capita spending on food is still relatively quite low because food is generally fairly cheap, relatively speaking. And so people are able to afford to eat much more and more regularly eat out, banquets, and then, of course, in China, you generally go and have a group of people and you order lots of different dishes and you all share it. You don't have a portion, you don't have a dish. Once you finish it, that's it. You're all sort of browsing around from a group of dishes. So you don't actually have a portion to restrict how much you intake. Then on top of that, people are generally continuing the habit of snacking throughout the day, so that Chinese habit of browsing on snacks throughout the day, and it used to be that we would be eating something like roasted nuts and seeds and, you know, washed down with a cup of tea. Now it's more likely to be, you know, you're eating a hamburger and pulling it down with a can of Coke or something. So it's the not just the quantity of food, but it's also the type of food that's being eaten. And then you've got broader social issues, realities, I suppose, that also have an effect on the way people eat and their relationship with food. Obviously, fast food arrived and became widely distributed throughout China. So it was available, it was convenient, it was cheap. People were more likely to go out and just down a couple of hamburgers just because they didn't have to think about it, because they had other more important things to do, i.e. making money. Also then, of course, you've still got the one-child policy in China. So you've got two parents, much wealthier than their parents' generation was. They were lavishing as much of their earnings and their love on that one child. Likewise, they would have two grandparents. So you've got the so-called six-pocket syndrome, where you've got all this lavishment coming down to this one child, the investment in that child. And there's also this idea that has prevailed that, you know, having a chubby baby is somehow healthier, and it's you know, a sign of good income, good wealth, and health. But of course, then that child grows up, and then they face the problem that they're then perhaps a little bit overweight, but they see that the body image that they're being projected in the media is of this weight-thin models or the you know, beefy, you know, very sort of muscly athletes, which doesn't fit with their own body reality. So you can see that where you know, growing up in China, you could perhaps have become a bit more depressed about that, and you know, one result of that might be you just can't continue to eat more. The other wider social issue that we also considered in the book, which was the urbanization of China, the fact that because it's very much an urban issue, or seems to be very much an urban issue, the massive urbanization of China is going to be significant. China is moving rapidly towards a situation that has never been in before, and that is that it will probably, within a few years, reach a point where the rural population is roughly the same size as the urban population. That's got all kinds of implications, because obviously you've got the urbanization requires building cities. It also has required in China demolishing old neighborhoods and completely rebuilding them. Whereas you have, say, in Shanghai, you know, 3-4-story townhouses, you know, having those flattened and replaced by a big apartment block, or more likely by office blocks, and then everybody's been shunted out into the suburbs. But if you think about it, in the last 30 years, were you born 30 years ago, you would have seen your whole neighborhood probably flattened and relocated. All the old social networks and civil society, sort of that kind of unspoken civil society, has been removed and relocated somewhere. Everybody's living in a different place. I always remember when I first went to Shenzhen, back in the beginning of the 90s, and I had a palpable sense when I first arrived there of just how much that was just like a Wild West town. You know, everybody was out to make money. Nobody was from there. Everybody was from somewhere else. They didn't have any of the social constraints that they would have had back home, you know, grandparents or whatever, telling them to behave themselves. And Shenzhen was, at that time, a cowboy town. I mean, people were, and in fact, a friend of mine was working in a nightclub. He used to have to carry a gun because of all the drugs problems and this sort of thing. So that kind of displacement creates, it creates a kind of a disharmony, and that creates a likelihood that people will feel less secure, and those insecurities could possibly also be a cause of why people are eating to excess. Obviously, we've also been seeing news reports of things like suicides, these guys going into kindergartens and killing spree and all that sort of. It's all, they're all symptoms. Obesity is one of those symptoms of the rapid and massive change that China has undergone. It's difficult to say how far we've reached a stage where it's going to sort of level off and start to, the growth rate will slow down in China in terms of the growth of obesity. To be honest, from a personal perspective, I'm still pretty sure that it's going to get worse before it gets better, because the children that have been born maybe 5 years ago, they're going to continue, I think, to have that kind of treatment lavished upon them. Kids who are now 15 years old will have already got to a state where they're probably or likely to be a bit overweight. And of course, all the problems that come with obesity in terms of illnesses, they take a long time to gestate and come to the fore. So something like type 2 diabetes, it takes a while before you might have got fat in your teens, but it won't come out until you're 40 or something, or perhaps earlier. But these things take a long time to come about. And then once they arrive, treatment for things like diabetes and heart conditions, if they don't kill you straight away, then you're going to be alive with that condition for perhaps 30, 40 years onwards. And the cost of treatment, therefore, is going to follow you. One of the things that came out of a more recent study, if I can find the right page, was there was a New England Journal of Medicine. They had some research results from China, a survey carried out, and basically the rates of type 2 diabetes and pre-diabetes were massive and had grown very, very rapidly. So the Chinese government is now having to face the costs of obesity and overweight in terms of the treatments. Now, you could say that the Chinese government has the political might to be able to dictate from on high, but I see this as an issue that you can't tell people what to do. You have to educate. And I think, again, coming back to the book, right at the end of the book, he quotes, I think it's Professor Philip James, who is the former chair of the London-based International Obesity Task Force, and one of his comments was that political will and increased public awareness will decide whether obesity is here to stay or go. I think that's quite true, but political will can only take it so far. It can provide, say, for example, fat taxes on high-calorie foods to penalise companies for producing those foods and also put people off buying them. But really, that's only so far. It has to come from education and helping people to understand dietary requirements and how to manage their food. But again, you know, one of the problems in China is that there are so few dietitians, either existing or being trained, and that's a real problem because there's just nobody out in the field able to advise at a grassroots level. So there are all sorts of issues that, that this whole obesity problem brings about that we try to cover in the book in as much detail as possible. But as I said at the start, the science and the numbers, the statistics and the surveys are all very vague, and it's very difficult still to get a real grasp on the exact size of the problem and how far it's going to carry on. Anyway, perhaps you can... Yeah, I'll
see. So,
school kids do in school, what's the sort of general government approach? I mean, there's so much emphasis on the Olympics and winning gold medals.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Sort of that filtered down to the sort of... To the
it's a good question. One of the things that we, having looked at the Olympics, in the run up to the Olympics, as we were finishing, it was interesting how little encouragement there was for participation in sports. On the back of the Olympics, you'd have thought that the Olympics would be the perfect vehicle to actually get grassroots sport and participation going, but it seems to be that whole opportunity was failed to grasp. We were just discussing over lunch, one of the things that Paul and I have noticed in several cities, particularly in Shanghai, is where you've got, say, high schools where, due to parental pressure, the high schools no longer provide any physical education, or didn't perhaps certainly recently, because the parents just wanted their kids to cram for exams. So they weren't getting any physical exercise at all, apart from perhaps walking to and from school. That is changing. I mean, I know of an example of a school up in Beijing where they introduced a rule that children graduating from the high school, before they graduate, they have to pass a physical fitness test. You have to be able to run a certain distance and swim a certain distance, etc. So there are changes being placed, but yeah, it's only piecemeal yet. And I think there's still a lot that can be done. Another good example, actually, while I think about it, was you know, Speedo, the swimming swimwear manufacturer. They actually started sponsoring up in Beijing these events where they had people like Michael Phelps go over and encourage all these Beijing kids to get into the pool and do all these sort of cool sports. Obviously that's good PR for Speedo, but it's also actually encouraging the development of these programs, these water sports programs that get people, you know, using the swimming pools and actually getting some exercise.
A question on that. By the way, raise all your hands so I know where you are.
I'm Alexandra Tracy from Horn Conventions. A lot of the conditions that you describe are really basic tenets of China's economic development and their targets and their growth programs, so urbanization, for example, and then, say, the automobile industry being a pillar industry for China. So it's a great goal, you know, every family has a car and they don't have to walk anywhere ever again. And, so at the same time, I'm sure the government wishes that the population would be healthy, but aren't those first developmental goals much more important at the moment?
I would say up until 2008 that would be the case, yes. I think the effect of the global financial crisis and the effect that had on China's export industry has made Beijing rethink how they need to develop their economy. Of course, they started talking very much more about developing the domestic economy. And also, particularly, the rural economy and trying to equalize some of the imbalances between rich and poor in China. So I think there's a shift in emphasis politically, very much away from quantity and more towards quality. Not only in terms of quality of the economy, but also things like the environment and healthcare. So I think that emphasis is now coming through. Looking at the leadership figures who are standing in the wings to take over in as the next generation of leaders in China, I think that looks like the people who are going to take over will continue with that kind of approach. Looking very much more at trying to equalize standards of living among people in China and also improve the quality of living as opposed to just, you know, making more money.
You never get some leaders in China out jogging. You see people killing whales. It'd be interesting if certainly the next generation, none of those candidates look like they're marathon. No. They are marathon runners, but only in the kind of metaphorical
Can we talk a little bit about...
Oh, please introduce yourself.
Oh, hi, I'm Jennifer Huang. I'm South Korean host. Can you talk a little bit about alcohol consumption and smoking and how that contributes to the obesity crisis in China?
Yeah, I think... Yeah, I haven't touched on that here, but in the book we do discuss that, and certainly in the research that we've done on those sectors, it's been interesting to note the shift. I mean, I can't remember what it was, I think it was 2002 or maybe earlier, that the Chinese government tried to get people to drink more beer rather than you know, the really strong grain spirits, because it was killing so many people. But of course, you know, you drink more beer, you're just going to get fatter. That trend kind of shifted again when all the green spirits manufacturers suddenly realized that if they actually made more expensive, good quality green spirits, then they could, you know, charge a premium, and then the sort of sales of that went up again. But alcohol plays a big part in the whole eating culture in China, and obviously that has an implication, as does smoking. And yes, I mean, all of these are concerns for the Chinese government. The problems have probably been there for many, many years, but only now, alongside obesity and other sort of social problems, are they becoming more significant as a part of that whole problem. But certainly, yes, they are significant enough for the government to try and meddle in you know, people's consumption of alcohol every so often. I mean, particularly, one of the things that most recently that happened was, of course, that they really cracked down on drink driving in the run-up to the Olympics. Whether or not they're still, you know, pursuing that same policy as rigorously, I don't know. But that was again, another issue that they tried to curb people's consumption of alcohol.
I think just, you know, there's a lot of taxes on alcohol. I don't know if there's all that, but are there taxes on certain sorts of food that are, you know, tax-free rights and high tax? Or,
No.
They haven't.
The government aware of it. They have a sort of flat rate of consumption taxes different levels of production. So the more levels of production and distribution, the more taxes are added to the station.
And then labeling, you said that, I didn't even know this, but apparently there's labeling for exposure for McDonald's and stuff in China.
Yeah, but I mean, as I said, you know, they are supposed to provide nutritional information to McDonald's. If you want to actually, we've tried this, you go into a McDonald's and it's not certainly not pinned up on the wall anywhere. You have to ask for it. And some guy wants to go up to the back and rummages around and pulls out the, you know,
is that even for every restaurant?
I'm not sure actually.
Because I've certainly never seen nutritional
information. No, I think in McDonald's that would just. I think what McDonald's were called up because they provided it everywhere else in the world except China, and somebody said, hold on a minute, you know, you should be doing the same in China as you're doing elsewhere. And of course,
one restaurant.
Yeah.
Pardon me.
When you started observing eating habits in Asians, one of the things I found really disturbing was an obsession with lard. You know, going to people's houses and they would specially render lard for my vegetables because vegetables taste better than lard. But in the Asians, people were fat. And I think they've changed over from rendering their own lard to using manufactured peanut oil.
Yeah.
And now they're fat. Is there a connection?
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to say because nobody's ever measured it. So you'd assume so. But I think it's not just necessarily the ingredients. I think it's also the quantity, and perhaps they're using the same ingredients, but then they're adding in other fatty ingredients. But it's also the fact that, you know, people now, you go anywhere in China, most of the TV channels have cookery shows and whatever. They're always sponsored by, you know, sauces or something like that. And if you have a look at the ingredients of those sauces, they're generally very sweet. A lot of sugar, salt, fats, whatever, and neither being poured all over the vegetables. Where previously you might have made your own sauce with less fat and other contents. Now it's just straight out of the bottle.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, hi, I'm Julie Chu. I'm a weight management specialist and certified health coach. My question is that I just heard last night someone mentioning that there are 50,000 different types of diets. And there have been research coming out of the U.S. showing that dieting causes weight gain.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to know what kind of correlation that is happening in China as well.
Again, there's been sort of little research in those sort of things anyway. I don't think that you have any statistics that prove one way or the other. What is interesting is that diets go through fashions and fads in China, just as they do everywhere else. And then you get, you know, all the other bits and pieces, like, you know, surgical weight loss and you know, these diuretic pills that, you know, all these stick thin Shanghai girls take. Basically, you know, they eat anything and come straight back out again. Then at the same time, you've got all the, you know, people say, oh, I really must go to the gym, and then you had all these gyms opening up all over China. And then, like everywhere else in the world, I suppose, 6 months later, so have you been to the gym? So they eventually give up the gym membership, and now the gym's closed down. So it's one of those things that, again, is a problem in China, is that everything's turning over so fast, it's changing. So yeah, I mean, you constantly see sort of different fad diets and diet pills appearing and disappearing all the time. It's hard to keep track of them, in fact.
Sorry, I'm not finished translation. I understand that in your book you are mostly focusing on China,
yeah.
But I'm wondering if you have any comparison to other parts of the world, because many of these problems seem to be very known to us in the Western world. So are other countries going through similar developments,
yeah,
experiencing something similar, or is it worse in China than in Russia, Brazil, Thailand, or anywhere else?
I think you're right. China is, in a sense, it's a very large, very fast-moving test case for what can happen in developing countries as they develop and become affluent.
And certainly, the same kind of issues that we saw in China, and we did look into not sort of that as in great detail as China, but in other countries, you did notice that there was evidence that the same was happening, particularly like India, Brazil, Mexico is way up there. I think Mexico even surpassed the US in terms of obesity rates. So it's not just an issue of China. It's appearing across the developing world as well. I mean, I live in Malaysia and you see the same problems of kids that get absolutely no exercise, who spend most of their feeding time in a McDonald's or KFC, and you know, go from air-conditioned car to air-conditioned mile to air-conditioned school back to an air-conditioned house and never go out. I mean, okay, it is pretty hot in Malaysia, and you know, it makes it difficult to go outside and go for a walk, for example. And when you do see people going for walks in the evenings, they're generally older people. Children just aren't going out and exercising. So yeah, and then again, we've got that problem emerging in Malaysia. So it's China is just like a very large and rapidly growing example of what can happen and how it can develop in other countries as well. And I think other countries are starting to look at this issue as well as a potential future problem for them.
I'm the Bourgeois Hamilton Advisors. I lived in Beijing in the 1980s for 3 years and have recently been going back doing business there. And you know, my observation is in sort of governmental banquets, even what should be sort of a working level banquet at lunchtime, the quantity and the variety of food is just astonishing, and it's really wretched excess. And it doesn't matter how much the Guailos ask for a simple meal, you know, it's impossible. It's just, this is the standard and there's no way around it. And it just, compared to, you know, 20 plus years ago, it just seems like there is, you know, again, so much emphasis on face, and this is what we do, and we express our prosperity through food and consumption, even much more so than years ago. Mm-hmm. So,
no, I would agree.
Just an observation.
I think that leads to the question of, is the government, we have other government officials who also have these arguments, are they starting to take this at all? Are there any signs that there may be some measures or moves to change the way it's developing?
I think so. No. Certainly not about. But then, you know, maybe certain cadres in certain parts of China are starting to think perhaps they should bring back their excesses. But then, of course, you know, you look at the general levels of corruption, those kind of excesses are going on anyway. So, no, I don't perceive any official, there's any movement within the body of cadres.
When I was a child in America, the President's Fitness Council that waxed and waned, you know, now everybody will carry their own, who knows, but I mean, it wasn't official presidential policy to encourage physical fitness. I have never heard the Chinese government in any official statement when they talk about it at all. Your book is the first thing that I've seen like this. So have any of, like, most of the people here have something with China, have you ever heard the government actually weighing on this particular on this issue? China obviously has had other priorities so far, but anyway, it's an interesting observation that it will become a anyway, unless anyone has it's 2 o'clock, we always try to keep out all the time. Unless anyone has anything else to be over, there's one other thing you should know, which is that Mr. Pratt is considered to sell copies of his books up at the table, home with a copy, maybe we'll sign for you as well to be well. So what am I just to that's a discount price. So we get the wholesale price here. So now is the time to buy it. You thought about buying it. You may want to buy new gifts for your clients. Anyway, thank you very, very much for coming.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, yes, yes. We always give.